So we're reading from the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita today, and we are reading from verse 15 to 22 of chapter 5. Or I wonder if that should be 13, actually. But anyway, I think 12 is where we stopped last time. So 13 is actually the next starting point. So I'll read the translations from 13, and then we'll recite 22 together. So text 13, in the village of Panchakroshi Vrindavan, at the site where the Govinda temple is now situated, there was a great temple where gorgeous worship of Gopal was performed. After taking baths at different bathing places along the river, Yamuna, such as Keshi Ghat and Kalia Ghat, the pilgrims visited the temple of Gopal. Afterwards, they took rest in that temple. The beauty of the Gopal deity stole away their minds, and feeling great happiness, they remained there for 2 or 4 days. One of the two brahmanas was an old man, and the other was young. The young man was assisting the old one. Indeed, the young brahmana always rendered service to the older one, and the old man, being very satisfied with his service, was pleased with him. The older man told the younger, "You have rendered various types of service to me. You have assisted me in traveling to all these places of pilgrimage. Even my own son does not render such service. By your mercy, I did not become fatigued while on this tour. If I did not show you any respect, I would be ungrateful. Therefore, I promise to give you my daughter in charity." The young brahmana replied, "My dear sir, please hear me. You are saying something very unusual. Such a thing never happens." And then we come to today's verse. Translation by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. "You are a most aristocratic family man, well educated and very rich. I am not at all aristocratic, and I am without a decent education and have no wealth." Purport. Due to pious activities, one can be enriched by 4 opulences. One may obtain birth in an aristocratic family, become highly educated, become very beautiful, or get a sufficient quantity of riches. These are symptoms of pious activities performed in one's past life. In India, it is still current for an aristocratic family never to consider a marriage with a common family. Though the caste may be the same, to maintain the aristocracy, such marriages are rejected. No poor man will dare marry the daughter of a rich man. Because of this, when the elderly brahmana offered the young brahmana his daughter, the young brahmana did not believe that it would be possible to marry her. Therefore he asked the elderly brahmana why he was proposing something unprecedented, asambhava. It was unheard of for an aristocratic person to offer his daughter to a person who was both uneducated and poor. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Gyanati Mirandasya Gyanachana Shalabhya Chakshvim Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So this is an interesting twist in the whole adventure. Up until now, it's been a nice pilgrimage with the younger brahmana and the older brahmana visiting places of pilgrimage. And I think the previous class on this topic was actually also given by me, because the Janmashtami break means we've missed 2 weeks. So previously we were speaking on Vrindavan, and it was described how these two personalities had traveled around, and they had visited holy places. They had visited the different forests in Vrindavan, the 12 forests. If you remember, the 7 forests, which are under Krishna's patronage on the west side, and the 5 forests of Balaram on the east side. And we discussed some of the different pastimes and places there, and the temples of the Goswamis. So here this is a place, and text 13 starts off at a place, Panchakroshi Vrindavan, which is the place where the current Govinda temple is. And we spoke something about that, how that temple has gone through much trouble and strife and persecution. So this ancient town of Panchakroshi Vrindavan was there, and this is where there was a deity of Gopal in a temple there. And this Gopal deity was very beautiful, and so these two brahmanas enjoyed with great relish the association of the deity, and they spent time there. Well, at this point, this elderly brahmana has expressed his great desire to the younger one that you have served me so well, even better than my own son. So I have to reciprocate in some way, and so let me offer the most valuable thing I have. Sometimes people consider this to be a very quaint and strange custom. I think if we mention just this phrase, I will offer you my daughter in charity, that would get a few strange looks from people, from people in the world. Daughter in charity? Father offering? I'll offer myself to whoever I want. Well, that was the culture, the ancient culture. And it would be actually, it is a sign of actually how things have changed and how status of individuals has become degraded. It would be a matter of great joy for the family when the father hands the daughter, which is considered to be the most valuable, valuable item, person, most valuable thing in a person's consciousness, in a family. Considered in many cultures that the daughter is like Lakshmi, isn't it? In traditional Indian culture, definitely the daughter is considered to be the girl is a manifestation of Lakshmi in one sense. So it would be a great joy for the father to hand that daughter over to a suitable person, and for the daughter, of course, that is also a great privilege to actually have the entire family very much concerned about her future welfare. So that is actually a mood which is almost completely absent now. That entire culture has disappeared. So this very notion that the father selects a husband for the daughter is a very strange concept for most people. But still, it is the basis for proper etiquette and culture. It's the basis for dharma. And many interesting pastimes have taken place based upon this concept. We know the marriage of Rukmini was beset by all these types of consideration. And so it is a very substantial event. When the son gets married in a family, okay, it's a big event also. But specifically for the father, when the daughter gets married, it is a moment of great separation. Because typically, you know, Prabhupada writes that the daughter is most dear to the father. The father has special affection for the daughter because he has played the role of protecting the girl throughout her entire life, before that role is handed over to the husband. So, especially where the daughter is concerned, you will have many, many detailed considerations. And in that whole episode with Rukmini, many others are involved. The brothers involved, Rukmi, you know, the brothers, the relatives, the cousins, the well-wishers. So it really isn't an arrangement between just two people. Two people who decide that now let's move forward on this path. Traditionally, it would be an arrangement, and it sometimes is described that in the Vedic system, a marriage isn't a marriage between a boy and a girl. It's a marriage between two families. And that whole situation going forward, which essentially unites the two families, is carried out after great consideration. So in many, many purports in other places in the Bhagavatam and in other parts of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada speaks about the superiority of that system, whereby instead of the girl selecting a most unsuitable boy as her husband, and the boy being attracted to a girl who is not suitable really in the long run, it is far better that based upon astrological calculations and considerations, and based upon considerations of senior brahmanas, that a compatibility is determined or at least assessed and taken into account. And this is because this institution was greatly valued in the past. It's been watered down now increasingly to an extent where it is little more than a facilitation mechanism for sense gratification. In order to regulate our activities of life, there are various measures and processes in place. And the importance of regulation is described in the scriptures, that when we follow a regulated material life, we actually have some capacity and some ability to channel more of our energy for spiritual life. Material life itself is troublesome. I'm sure everyone knows that material life is troublesome. Whether you're rich, you're poor, you're fat, you're thin, whatever it is, you're man, you're woman, material life is troublesome. From whatever status you happen to be in, there will be troubles, and you will resent those troubles. And in many cases, you will wish they weren't there. So that is material life. So when there is a culture which attempts to prioritize spiritual life, or at least promote it, or at least encourage it, if prioritizing it is not possible, then at least promoting it should be there. And if it is difficult to promote it, then at least in some way it can be encouraged. So when a culture tries to do these things, typically it tries to regulate the material aspects of life so that they do not cause undue disturbance. After all, as Lord Rishabhdev explains, Nunam pramatta kurute vikarma yat indriya pritaya apranoti nasadu manye yat atmanoyam asan apikleshada ashadeha. That this principle of sense gratification is pervasive. It completely overrides the mind. When one aspires excessively out of madness for the objects of the senses, one becomes increasingly degraded, and one performs an increasing level of sinful activity. That sinful activity leads to more and more complication as time goes on. So he goes on to say that pumsa striya mithuni bhava metan tayor mitho hridaya grantim ahur ato griha kshetra sutapta viter janasya moho yamaham mameti. At the heart of this problem is the fundamental connection between male and female in this world. On the basis of this connection, attraction between male and female, which is a standard situation, it's a standard quality, a standard interaction in the world, a great attraction and knot develops in the heart. That knot is the basis for the production of so many other elements, like family, children, home, etc. And together, they all combine to prevent one from moving forward in spiritual life. So in one sense, that is quite a serious assessment. That this thing that's created due to the attraction between male and female, it causes us to be completely distracted from the goal of life. So given that it is such a dangerous concept, and given that it is also a universal concept, that no one can pretend artificially to eradicate this. It would actually even be wrong to do so, because that attraction is ultimately coming from the pure spiritual attraction. The pure spiritual attraction between Radha and Krishna. And then the pure spiritual attraction between the devotee and the Supreme Lord. Now in the material world, when that is translated, or as we say, pervertedly reflected, things switch around a little. First of all, who is a Purusha in this world? Well, every single person is a Purusha. A man and a woman are both considered Purusha. Why? Because they're both enjoyers. The role of the Purusha is enjoyer. Here in the material world, they both think they're enjoyers. So they're both Purusha. But actually, they're also both Prakriti. Why? Because they're both still in the fundamental position that they are the servant of the Lord to be enjoyed by the Lord. That status doesn't change depending on what the person thinks. The status that we are a spirit soul subservient to Krishna does not change whatever philosophical concepts we develop in our mind. That still remains a fundamental truth. So we have these two opposing things going on. Constitutionally, we are a servant of the Lord in the role of Prakriti. But we are acting as Purusha in this world. We're acting as enjoyer. So we have this misconception that is a companion with us throughout our whole life. Now, what a troublesome situation is created because of this. Just as we discussed last time, that we are a spirit soul encaged within a material body. That itself is an incompatible situation or a non-optimal situation. Something spiritual needs a spiritual vehicle through which to act. It does not need a material vehicle which gives it deficient instruments, and deficient instruments such as the subtle ones, the mind, intelligence, and ego. It is far better for the spirit soul to express itself fully through the spiritual mind, intelligence, spiritual ego, and then a spiritual body. That is the correct way for the spirit soul to be situated. So many problems happen because of that misconception. And so therefore, spiritual life or material life with spiritual intentions is also very difficult due to the presence of this contradiction in terms of Purusha and Prakriti. So based upon that, people's material lives go on. They go on and they try to acquire different aspects related to matter. And Prabhupada mentions here four items which are based upon one's prior pious activities. Birth in an aristocratic family, high education, great beauty, or great wealth. So these are things that people aspire for to different extents. And it seems harmless also. But the problem is that, as Queen Kunti says, one who is aspiring for these things and who considers these to be the aim of life, or is trying to progress in these areas, janma aishware shruta shribir edamana madapuman nevarhatya bidhatum vaitvam kinchana gochara, such a person cannot actually surrender to you, the Supreme Lord, with sincere feeling. When someone is trying to progress on the path of material progress in terms of these four categories, it is not possible to surrender to the Lord with sincere feeling. Now, I always find this a very interesting statement of Queen Kunti, because Queen Kunti is a personality who had all of these four items, she had them. So for her to make a statement like this is quite bold. But there's a very interesting aspect which should be considered. It is the phrase that trying to progress in these areas. That is the item that's important. As this purport explains, one will get certain opulences just due to their previous pious activities, and they will come to them. But then it's another matter to be trying to improve your material condition in terms of these opulences. If you have something, that cannot really be considered attained in any way. But if you are endeavoring for more and more of it, then that comes into this category of something that can distract your consciousness. And that is the tricky item to watch out for. At which level do we consider that what we have is enough? It's not an easy one at all. Because if you are, for example, born in a very rich family, within your lifestyle, within your social circles, within your interactions, there is a certain level of opulence that is expected and demanded. So for that person to maintain themselves just on a kind of a normal basis requires a great deal of wealth. And that also requires then a great deal of creation of wealth through various schemes and business enterprises, activities, or whatever it is. So at which point does such a person who needs a substantial amount of inflow just to maintain their situation consider that they have too much or that they're ever endeavoring too much? Whereas if you take a poor person who has a very simple life, lives day to day, not much in the bank, but they're greedy and they're trying to acquire more and more and more. They want the same amount of money as the person who is in a very opulent situation. Who is more greedy? You can't really tell. It's difficult. On the one hand, you could say the poor person is actually greedier than the rich one, because the rich person already has a certain level of requirement and they're simply fulfilling the level of requirement. Whereas the poor person has no need for that level of requirement, but still they're aspiring for it. Now, of course, typically in Kali Yuga, no one tries to assess themselves according to the level of requirement. They just want more and more and more. So you can safely say that for most people in Kali Yuga, they are all greedy. You can pretty much safely say that. The poor person is greedy, the rich person is greedy. It never ends. So these things are interesting. Krishna is not poor. He's not Daridra, as some people like to portray him. He's not Daridra Narayan. He is the richest person. He's the most opulent person who also has no interest in any of those things. Because he's also the most renounced. So sometimes he chooses to act in a place where he gives up all his riches, all his power, all his opulence. And he goes to Vrindavan, where he just behaves like a sweet cowherd boy and just plays. So Krishna is also the most renounced person in one sense. It's described, Lakshmi Sahasra Shatasam Brahma Sevya Manam Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami in the Brahma Samhita, that he is tended to hand and foot by hundreds and thousands and millions of Lakshmis and Gopis. He doesn't need anything. But sometimes he gets fed up of it all and just goes off to a simple village, Vrindavan, where he encounters so many difficulties from various demons, from various individuals. And he manages just to have fun there. He causes mischief, he annoys his parents, he reciprocates with great love with his parents. He causes great difficulty to the gopis. He gives them great pleasure also. That's Krishna. He doesn't depend on any facility or wealth. And certainly whatever he has is completely outside of this consideration of karma and previous pious activities. So Krishna is a very, very interesting personality who can handle all the opulences of the world without them affecting him in the slightest. But we're not like that. There is a great danger because we've surrendered to the objects of the senses. And the consequence of that is that we are going, descending deeper and deeper into this world until we make a determination to get out. As the Gita explains, Dhyayato Vishayan Bhumsam Sangaste Shupajayate Sangat Sanjayate Kama Kamat Krodha Vijayate Krodha Bhavati Samoha Samoha Smritir Vibrama Smritir Brahmshad Buddhi Nasha Buddhi Nasha Pranashyati. That from the objects of the senses one develops attachment to them. From such attachment, lust develops. From lust, anger arises. From anger, delusion arises. Intelligence is lost, memory is lost. One falls down into the material world. An entire sequence of degradation. So what we need to do in life is to try to make sure that these potentially venomous serpents, these objects, cause us the least amount of difficulty in life. And as we've just read, it is this principle of attraction between male and female that is essentially the root cause of us acquiring and continuing to acquire objects. Because the highest satisfaction possible in this world is the connection between men and women through sex life. It is a perverted reflection of the original pure love of Krishna, but nevertheless, it is the highest thing available here. So all the objects, all of those things, essentially always serve this principle. So therefore, civilized cultures have this institution of marriage. Uncivilized cultures do not. The cats and dogs, or cultures which are effectively behaving like cats and dogs, there's no real consideration. It's just, let's do it. That's it. And now somehow we have developed propaganda which successively, with each passing decade, derides the institution of marriage and actually makes it seem more advanced to disregard the restraints, restrictions, or constraints of marriage or the social customs. How quaint and outdated. I mean, I can't possibly imagine this. Better we just find our own partners. Better we do whatever we want. A few years later, it doesn't matter. Let's just divorce. Come on. It's simple. Let's just get on with it. Why all this entrapment, this hierarchy, all this patriarchal concern for the daughter? Why bother with it? But still, I want to be happy at the end of it. But I'm not going to go through the equation which states that Or look at the evidence which states that after following my new propaganda, the level of happiness has not increased. We kind of ignore that little aspect of the equation. We've gone down a whole path of degrading culture in order to become happy. But we look at the results, and they don't support our actions. So it's strange. So we are given this chance, and I mean, Prabhupada is quite bold with these statements. In almost every chapter of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada speaks about cultural dealings between men and women, cultural interactions. Now, in a spiritual work, one can argue, why is there so much focus on men and women if we're supposed to all be transcendental? Well, the point is that we're not transcendental right now. We're aspiring for transcendence, but we can't pretend that we're on that platform. Neither do persons like these brahmanas do that. Neither does Lord Chaitanya. Neither did Rukmini, neither did Krishna, neither does any advanced person in the Bhagavatam consider themselves to be transcendental to considerations. So we should not be naive in this. If we're a lady, we can look at the exalted ladies of the Bhagavatam for our inspiration. Draupadi, Queen Kunti, Gandhari, Rukmini. How do they conduct themselves in life? What values do they live by? What austerities do they go through? What sacrifices do they make for their own status, position, or comfort for the sake of duty, as these great ladies did? Devahuti, there are so many others. And so for men also. There are so many exalted men in the Bhagavatam. Kardama Muni, Krishna. I mean, he's a tricky one, Krishna, but at least we can look at some good examples which we are supposed to follow from Krishna. Dangerous to imitate all his behavior. Maybe Ram is a bit safer in that sense. Lord Ram. And then there are so many other great exalted persons. And so we do have many, many good role models. So life in general is about adopting the right role model. When you see someone in modern society and they're portrayed and they're put on a pedestal, they could be a rock singer, they could be, you know, a great popular person, a TV lovey, you know, whatever it is. Someone who is aspired for. Then the way they conduct themselves acts as an example for people. Now we know what that can provide us. If we take our example and our inspiration from those people and their cultures and their culture and their lifestyle and their values, we can see what values they live by their lifestyle and their results. Sri Sri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. If we follow those people, then we will develop that consciousness and we will eventually get the same status as them, as time goes on. But if instead, if we actually follow the exalted persons in our scriptures, the exalted devotees who actually demonstrate character, then that becomes something uplifting. Because if we develop great affection for a person who acts with great duty, now one of my favorite persons in the Mahabharata is Draupadi, because she goes through so much difficulty. She goes through so much pain. She is mistreated so extensively. But she never deviates from her duty. Never deviates from her principles. Never deviates from her chastity. She follows and sets such an example for people. How to be situated in one's own role without aspiring for something else, just because it is fed through us through propaganda. That this is more preferable for you because, come on, it's a modern world, let's do this. She sticks to her role, her responsibilities, puts up with all the nonsense that's given, that's unleashed on her by so many other unfortunate agents. And essentially it's described that the entire Mahabharata war, in one sense, takes place because of this offense to Draupadi. When her hair was disrespected, That was an offense which led to the war. Imagine that. So when there is a person who is very chaste, very together in terms of their culture and their practice, then they derive actual great power. And Krishna doesn't always do these things on time, on our time scale, but he does it according to his time scale. He eventually reinstates such devotees in their rightful positions. So he always takes care of persons who follow culture, who follow etiquette, who follow the norms, who follow culture, who follow cultural dealings which are based upon solid spiritual principles. It's an interesting aspect that we are aspiring for a stage when we are completely transcendental to all material considerations. But part of that means we have to deal very carefully with the material considerations that exist right now. And this example has been given by Lord Chaitanya in his dealings. His very strict, very focused, very loving dealings, but full of great consideration, especially in his at the point at which he took sannyas. Very great considerations of behavior and character. And now here in the case of these two brahmanas also, these two brahmanas are exalted persons. But still, this item has now come up that the potential for marriage has developed. And there is a great concern over its legitimacy. If there is anyone who could claim to be aloof from material life, it is these two brahmanas, because their life is pure. But no, rather they are taking this situation with great care, great attention, great consideration. And they want to do the right thing. There are so many subtle cultural details here. The very notion of this younger brahmana serving the older one for such an extended period. And as we find out later, solely for the pleasure of Krishna. Such an exemplary attitude. It's so nice that this person serves the elder brahmana because the brahmana is very dear to Krishna. That is why. Even more than the brahmana's own son. So it is another trait that we see that when there are exalted persons in society, spiritually exalted, and perhaps also materially exalted, as in the case of Daksha or as in the case of this elderly brahmana, we will see later on that sometimes they may develop wrong mentalities later, or their offspring, their children, do not always behave in the same cultured manner as the parents. In Kali Yuga, that is increasingly the case. That Krishna says, you know, he says that one will be born into a family of great aristocracy in the Gita, or a family which is very conducive for spiritual growth, which makes life very conducive, depending on what one has done in this life. But in these days, it's increasingly degrading, because the persons who are meant to be maintaining the principles of original true aristocracy are themselves now very, very degraded. And aristocracy is present in every culture. But the modern culture, and of course aristocracy is partly to blame for this, that because they have misbehaved. Persons in prominent positions have misbehaved. So now the reaction comes in the sense that that role itself, those privileges, those responsibilities, are increasingly being diminished through legal means, through taxing, through whatever it is. So we are heading towards a stage as Kali Yuga progresses where everyone is increasingly equivalently disqualified. No one can really have piety exhibited anymore. No one can have higher values. Why? Because persons around them will ridicule them for possessing higher values. Even if a senior, like a father or a spiritual master or a husband or someone has a higher value, it will not be correct for us to follow them because it's quaint and primitive. So therefore we become degraded. And in due course of time, we are no longer entitled to whatever we have been entitled to due to our birth. That's the way things are progressing in Kali Yuga. So we can look at these cultural details. We can look at the cultural refinement exhibited here of the senior brahmana of the junior one. And the great care and attention the junior brahmana has in protecting the senior one. We can all understand that he has done this physically. After all, he's been serving him. He's been serving him, tending to his body, making sure he's comfortable, making sure he's well situated. That everyone can appreciate. But they can't appreciate another dimension of this, that this subsequent pastime that's going to happen with Sakshi Gopal is about protecting the senior brahmana's brahminical status. This junior brahmana is now also going to do that. This whole pastime demonstrates that point, that out of great love and care and subservience, he is now going to ask a deity to do something which he has never done before, to protect the honor of the senior brahmana. And we're going to come across, as this story proceeds during the chapter, of so many interesting discourses between the family members of this senior brahmana, who display very strange behavior. Then interesting interactions between Gopal, the deity himself, and this younger brahmana. Then between the two of them. And it is something which leads to a great adventure. But it all starts off here with a situation of great etiquette and respect. A highly cultured situation between two brahmanas. And one of the brahmanas is now offering, according to a high standard of culture, his daughter to the younger brahmana as a token of gratitude, as an item of gratitude. So a very interesting cultural setting, which is very difficult to directly relate to in today's day and age. But when we read about such pastimes, and in Krishna Leela, in the Mahabharata, hopefully we can get a little sense of it. Radha and Krishna's pastimes take place within very interesting circumstances created by culture. There is no consideration of equality there. Many of Radha Krishna's pastimes simply disappear if you consider them all to be equal. No, there is great hierarchy. There's great difference. There's great difference between girls and boys. There's great difference between senior and junior. Jatila and Kutila, the senior, the senior spice agents in the Leela. They're offered great respect. They're offered great, they're offered a significant status. Not that they're disregarded simply because they're troublesome. No, the whole pastime relies on a whole set of events and situations created based upon a specific cultural considerations, not today's cultural considerations. Today, many people like to use the word culture, but what they're actually promoting is the complete opposite of culture. But they can't dare to be called uncultured. So they use the same word culture and portray their own activities as highly cultured. But hopefully, no sane person should fall for this. Because we just have to read every page of Prabhupada's books. Every chapter of the Bhagavatam will tell us very clearly what is actual culture versus the propaganda. It will make it crystal clear. So the only way we can go on in this illusion is if we don't read Prabhupada's books. So who accepts that as a challenge? Who wants to be in illusion? Well, don't read Prabhupada's books. You might even have a seemingly happy life if you just disregard Prabhupada's books. Your life might be so convenient if you just disregard what's in Prabhupada's books. You might even get a big position, big status. Now, if you actually consider Prabhupada's books, yes, you may encounter a few problems. Because when some unfortunate propaganda comes your way, you're not going to humbly sit there and swallow it. You won't exhibit humility at that time. When the founder Acharya's words and principles are being contradicted. So that might make your life a little tricky. Because those who would like to unleash contrary propaganda will not be happy at your resistance. Are you ready for that? Are you brave enough? Are you man enough? Are you woman enough? Now, these are all fun aspects and fun elements that we have to go through in life. The chance we have to become Krishna conscious is a great chance, but it also has responsibilities. To preserve Prabhupada's mission also becomes our responsibility. And so if we become very strong, very careful in spiritual practice and have a great attraction to Prabhupada's books, then we will also act to preserve his mission according to his books, not according to other principles. So we all have a desire that Prabhupada's mission will expand and flourish and grow, and there'll be hundreds and millions of devotees around the world. We all want that. But there's a little prerequisite to that, that we have to know how to do it. And we have to know what Prabhupada has planned for this to happen. And we have to know the principles that Prabhupada explains in his scripture. So that is the challenge before us. And as this story proceeds, we'll get some more and more interesting details. So I'll stop there. Are there any questions? Yes, Prajan Prabhu.
Thank you for a nice class. And interesting thing, expression when you say of the times, how things change, and our attitudes towards the finer sentiments of how we treat each other. Mm. And also, it can be said too that what bothers me that, well, I remember once upstairs, we were having prashad, and somebody said, oh, this prashad's really sick. And you know, this is the modern age, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, this is like... this. But what my concern is that if we're not careful, because they are editing the books now into such a way where they think, because of the time and circumstance, they think, or they may make a decision based on a colloquial type of language. And I remember when they did the English Bible, they just lost so much. And
yes,
it bore no resemblance of the previous version. It certainly lost its spirituality in many, many ways. And this is my main concern, is that we try and convert what Prabhupada said at his time, which was understood to be of a certain type of language, that will lose its essence and cultural refinement. So a comment on that, if you would.
Yes, we do desire to maintain and preserve our culture. But one of the very important principles for a preacher is that, and actually Prabhupada gives this as a definition of self-realization. He said real realization. In the first canto of the Bhagavatam, he explains that realization means that one must be able to present the subject matter in an interesting manner for all classes of people. The subject matter in an interesting manner for all classes of people. Yeah. That is called realization. Now, all classes of people means different language styles, different colloquialisms, different natures, different cultures. We've been raised and born and brought up in different cultures, different families with different values. And a preacher's job, Prabhupada says, is specifically not to parrot fashion, repeat the words of either scripture or the acharya. He says, Shukadev Goswami is known as a parrot. Shuka means parrot. And he's not called a parrot because of his rote, verbatim repetition of what he had heard. Rather, Prabhupada says he's known as a parrot because a parrot has a special quality. As Prabhupada says, that when a parrot's beak bites a mango, the fruit becomes even sweeter. And so Shukadev Goswami has that quality, that when he has digested the Bhagavatam and is expressing it, it has become even more relishable. Nigama kalapataror galitam phalam shukhamukhad amrita drava samyutam vibhata bhagavatam rasamalayam muhura aho rasika bhuvi bhavaka. So it is a necessary duty of the preacher that they will relay and convey the contents of the scriptures in a manner which is accessible to the audience. That is a very important consideration. We are not rigid, stoic adherents to the specific language. A simple example, in Prabhupada's time, Prabhupada used the word cult. He would use the word cult, the cult of Lord Chaitanya. He would refer to himself as propagating the cult of Lord Chaitanya. Well, at that time, the word cult largely, I mean, that's its origin is culture. Cult means something that follows in line with the culture. So when Prabhupada was speaking, he was speaking with a sense that I am propagating the culture of Lord Chaitanya. Now, as time has gone on, that word has taken on a completely different connotation. After certain disasters, Waco and these other places, you know, big problems happened by cult leaders. So many people also like to label us as cults because it suits their agenda. I mean, of course, when someone actually comes here and considers the values that we live by, they have to be a little strange if they come to the conclusion that we're a cult, according to the modern sense. So that is an example where a terminology which was relevant in the 60s or 70s is no longer suitable today. If we ignore such considerations, and in our preaching we just rigidly keep just repeating the same words, we are going to become increasingly irrelevant to people. The principles and the message has to be conveyed intact, and that's what Prabhupada calls a realized person, who can convey the message with suitable language, with suitable words. The tendency today is to look at a principle and just to think, okay, this is weird, I can't relate to this. I'm just going to ignore this for a while. Or if someone asks me to present it, I'll just say something which is more in line with the modern day version. That's a disservice. It's not a disservice to try to explain in better language something that people could understand. But it is a disservice to explain a different concept to people, whichever language it is in. So our mission will continue if senior persons who are well versed in Prabhupada's books, who in many cases were actually given the task by Prabhupada himself to carefully edit his work so that it would be portrayed and paka. You know, Prabhupada originally, when he published the Bhagavatam, the first three volumes were done largely by himself. No, he did everything. He wrote, he translated, he even typeset. But then, when he came and he started the mass propagation of his books, he engaged multiple individuals who were expert, because he wanted the English to be expert according to the standard of English amongst English speakers. So therefore, some of the translations that we have are very poetic and very beautiful. They're very nice. They're fitting. So Prabhupada handed that responsibility to someone else. He handed responsibility to others to proofread very carefully what's written. Then he had a Sanskrit editor. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki Jai. Now, Sanskrit editor, a very dangerous task, because so many people take original Sanskrit and completely misportray it. You have to be highly competent to speak Sanskrit and use Sanskrit and give purport on it. You have to be very, very competently empowered by the parampara to do that. But he empowered a Sanskrit editor. So Prabhupada has done very unconventional, very interesting things, but under his careful, watchful oversight. And so we pray that that spirit comes through. If you distribute books on the street, one of the things people say to you is, I don't read. There you go. I don't read. Sorry, I don't read. I don't like to read. Or I read one of your books once and I didn't understand any of it. Sometimes people say the language is too strange. What are you going to do? This person is excluded forever from spiritual life? Or do we make some attempt to represent, to explain, to give some commentary, to give something which brings them to Prabhupada's books? The particular language should not be a barrier. At least that much is our duty. We have to maintain the principles intact, but any and all languages are welcome. So, just imagine actually, this notion of changing and only exists in the English language. Right, in other languages, it's already a change. The language, the words, the construction, the grammar, just consider it from that point of view. It's a substantial change. Do we think that when, I think Patanjali Prabhu, he translated the Gita into Korean, do we think for a moment that the sentence structure in Korean is going to look anything like the English, or indeed anything like the Sanskrit here? But is the same message, the same content, the same potency conveyed? That is the challenge. So any and all languages, Prabhupada wanted all cultures, all people to be involved, and to have Krishna accessible to them.
I suppose really it's a reflection of what Bhaktivinoda Thakur did, didn't it? Because he was trying to bring the Vedas to people who couldn't understand Sanskrit, wasn't it? And he did it in such a way, he took the heart of the message, didn't he? And conveyed it in the local language, actually, in Bengali or whatever.
Yes,
it was.
That's right.
Yeah, I suppose that's a similar vein, isn't it?
Yes.
To make it accessible to those people who didn't know Sanskrit, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I take your point. Thank you.
Thank you. Ian Prabhu?
Hi, Krishna Prabhu. Thank you so much for the amazing class. I wanted to ask a question about something that you touched on a little bit when you were talking about, you know, the idea of marriage and how the best thing for one to do is to, use astrology as a means to kind of see what's the best decision to make. I just wanted to talk on astrology specifically, so bearing off a bit. So for us who are taking to devotional service, we hear that, you know, once you come to Krishna, things change. So how should we factor in astrology in our lives as we take to Krishna consciousness? What do you suggest?
Interesting. It can sometimes provide us insights into our karmic situation. But as you rightly say, that is being overridden. It typically doesn't all disappear all at once for people as they're practicing. And there are certain traits and certain things have happened in their life which astrologically match up. In terms of practical use from a devotional perspective, it's not particularly useful. It's not something that our devotional direction is determined by. Our devotional direction is largely under the care of Krishna, to the extent we're surrendered to him. And he may use all our astrological traits. He may not, if he wants to also. He can alter things. He can rearrange planets. You know, Krishna can, just to protect the word of his devotee, he can cause the sun to not set, as he did in the Mahabharata. Don't think for a moment that the celestial arrangements are superior to Krishna. When Krishna appears, he arranges all the heavens so that they look perfect. And then the astrologers say, wow, this is a divine arrangement. This is portraying the birth of an exceptional person. Amazing things Krishna does. Krishna is in charge, not the arrangement. And one nice way to look at it is, someone explained that if you look at a clock tells you the time according to the hands and the numbers. But that clock is not controlling time. That clock is representing time to you. So when you look at the arrangements in the heavens, the movements of the planets, that is a representation like the clock, conveying more subtle realms of knowledge to you. But those exist independently anyway, under the guidance of Krishna or superior powers. So we have to deal with that. Now specifically in marriage, Prabhupada says in many cases, many places, he said this compatibility should be observed. And he advises it is still carried out. So it is a factor. It's not the only factor. There are many, many statements Prabhupada makes In one place he says, character and qualities in determining suitability of a union are more important than beauty and wealth. He says that in one place. In today's thing, there is a consideration of beauty, wealth, status. So it's many, many factors are involved. A person's material nature is a consideration. A person's propensities, as revealed by astrology, is a consideration. A person's role in spiritual progress is a consideration. Different considerations are there. So all of them have to be considered by seniors as best as possible. And then you can actually have something that's successful. It may not be always materially perfect. There's no marriage that's as described in Bollywood or Hollywood or any of the other movies that are ever produced. No real marriage is ever like that. There is always plenty of strife and trouble along the way. The question is, amidst it all, is there substantial spiritual progress for both parties? That's the thing. So that requires Krishna's help, really. So the more devotionally situated we are, the better chance we have of it. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, we'll stop there. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki. Srila Prabhupada ki.